Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about sustainability and chocolate.
Yes. To make it more digestible.
Oh.
Yeah. Hey, uh-huh. Hey. We have arrived at our penultimate Hawaii episode, which means, yes, it is time to talk about something that we've touched on in a lot of these episodes, sustainability, particularly when it comes to food, since, again, we are a food show.
Hypothetically. On paper.
And, yeah, to do that, we want to look at a case study of chocolate. And if you remember, we've already done an episode on chocolate a while back.
That would be Chock Full of Chocolate from December of 2017.
Oh. but during our time on Oahu, we got to interview Dylan Butterball, one of the founders of Manoa Chocolate Hawaii.
Yeah, and he was delightful.
Oh, yeah.
Manoa is a bean-to-bar chocolate maker, which means that they source whole cacao beans, which are actually seeds from farmers, then roast them, shell them, crush the nibs, which are the kind of operative part, into liquid, maybe mix in other things, and then form the resulting liquid chocolate into bars or whatever. And note that this is more involved than what a chocolatier does, which is buy that resulting chocolate and reform it into whatever. There are a growing number of bean-to-bar chocolate makers out there as consumers and creators have realized that a lot of the chocolate we've been eating, the cacao farmers who make it possible haven't been paid fairly for it. They aren't living well. They've been backed into corners where they've had to use practices that have damaged their land and their other resources. In some places, that's turned into desperation, which has turned into forced labor and child labor. But bean-to-bar means that you can much better support farmers and help them protect their lands and their livelihoods.
And I guess that brings us to our question, sustainability. What is it?
Well, sustainability is getting a product or an outcome in a way that ensures that you're not totally screwing up the system that created that product or outcome, like to the point that you're not going to be able to get it again in the future. And it applies to, like, all kinds of things, probably all things that we humans do now that I think about it. But when it comes to food, what you're talking about is not screwing up the physical part of the earth where the food is grown and not screwing over all the people who work to create it and get it to you.
And so much goes into that.
Oh, yeah. Again, with chocolate as an example, okay, to make chocolate, you need fertile land to grow the cacao, access to clean water, ways of mitigating pests and getting the cacao to grow just the best that little cacao plant that could. you need appropriate weather. You need materials and resources to process the raw fruit. You need education on how to best do all of that, and then access to someone who can pay you for it so that you can, you know, like, have a home and eat food and all those other important things.
Right.
Oh, but and then you need infrastructure to transport the beans, and the chocolate maker needs resources and equipment to process them and access to people who will pay them for it so that they can have a home and eat food. But then you've got to consider the people who make those machines and the paper that the chocolate is wrapped in and the energy costs and carbon footprint of all of this transport and processing, and it is dazzlingly complicated.
And here we are, little old podcast saver, doing our best.
Oh.
Because it only gets more complicated as the population of the world grows and changes. Various diets have directly impacted environmental health. For example, as the world has grown more affluent, the consumption of meat has risen. We've talked before about how much more energy it takes to raise animals than plants, and certain kinds of animals more than others. Among other things, livestock plays a significant role in changing the environment, and not for the better. It can destroy soil, deplete and pollute water supplies, reduce biodiversity, and increase greenhouse gases.
Yeah, because animals burp and fart, like, a lot.
Yeah.
And stuff like carbon dioxide and methane and also ammonia from urine is not the friendliest stuff. Livestock can have effects that you might not think about, like herds of animals compact the soil where they graze, which means less rainwater can sink in, which means more runoff, which erodes the soil and the nutrients in the soil needed to grow the grass that the animals were grazing on in the first place.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Oof. There's also the discussion of transported food versus local food. Uh-huh. Food miles refers to the distance between production and consumption. While generally local does have a lesser environmental impact, it depends on the food and the type of transportation. Seasonality is a contributor as well as is food waste, which we talked about in our food waste food episode. They're all food episodes, aren't they, really? And our expiration dates episode. Food access and insecurity are other pieces of this massive puzzle that we've also talked about before in our interview with Pepper Bowen, the food and water attorney from New Orleans.
To try to wrangle all of this.
Yeah.
In 2015, the United Nations put together 17 Sustainable Development Goals with the ultimate aim to, by 2030, quote, end all forms of poverty, fight inequalities, and tackle climate change while ensuring that no one is left behind. Which is a lot, but the goals get really granular, and they've done a lot of research. Goal 12 of the 17 is responsible consumption and production. And, yeah, they determined that the way we're going, like with our current lifestyles, we would need the equivalent of nearly three Earths worth of natural resources by 2050, assuming that the global population reaches 9.6 billion, as it is estimated to do. They also report that over a billion people currently do not have access to clean water and that one-third of our food supply is wasted, and that the food industry accounts for 30% of our energy consumption and 22% of greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah. And this has caught a lot of people's attention. A look at the 2008 Google Ingram revealed that that year, sustainability showed up 7 times more often than Star Wars and 12 times more often than Steve Jobs.
And I'll remind you, like, the iPhone was, like, a new thing then. So that was a, you know.
Yeah. And Star Wars. Oh, the memories. Anyway, corporate interests have broadened and muddied the waters when it comes to the actual definition of sustainability, meaning that search results can have a whole range of definitions for that word.
Yeah. So consumers and creators aren't unaware that these things are problems. But yeah, it is so huge that it's confusing, especially when you take into consideration that that whenever there's money to be made, you're going to have some people acting in bad faith. And it is a big business. Advertising Age estimated that back in 2011, environmentally friendly products raked in over $40 billion in sales in the United States, including organic food, electric and hybrid cars, green cleaning products, stuff like that. And the UK government estimated that globally, that number might have been $5.2 trillion.
Trillion? We don't get to talk about trillions that much.
I'm glad we don't.
Yeah, it's just a blank.
It's, yep.
In my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's
a lot.
Yeah. And to make it better, you would have to look at every single one of those products and their creation if you were going to say whether and exactly how much better they were for the environment than conventional products, how much of a difference they made.
Right. And we do have some Hawaii-specific numbers for you. As we said in our Welcome to Oahu intro episode, being an island, and a pretty isolated island at that, impacts the conversation around sustainability there. During the infamous poke battle, infamous to us at least, we caught up with Denise Hayashi Yamaguchi, co-founder and CEO of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival and executive director of the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation. So she is steeped in these conversations. Here's Denise.
So, you know, 85% of what we consume here in our islands, not just on Oahu, but throughout the state, is imported. And 15% is what we've been able to grow ourselves or to feed ourselves. And at one time, Hawaii was 100% sustainable. The Native Hawaiians were amazing people. They had a system, a watershed system called the Ahupua'a, where everything that grew at the top, it affected everything at the bottom, and they were able to live off the land. And so we're trying to bring some of that back because, you know, when sugar and pineapple were here, we were two crops. And when they decided to move out, or when, you know, things got so expensive here in Hawaii and it got cheaper to grow them elsewhere, we had to start a diversified agricultural industry here, and it's been tough. So that's what everyone is trying to work on, is moving the needle so that we can better sustain food, be more food sustainable.
We heard about that needle from a number of people, such as Taylor Kellerman, who's the director of agriculture and land stewardship at Kualoa Ranch, which is this gorgeous area that hosts movie productions and tourism and cattle and crops and aquaculture. If you're familiar with that scene in the first Jurassic Park where they're running over the hill and the dinosaurs are chasing them and then there's T-Rex and it's all like, brr!
Yeah. Oh, I know that scene.
Yeah.
We need to share that picture.
Oh, gosh, we do. There's so many pictures I haven't shared yet. Okay, anyway, yes, here's Taylor.
Sustainability of the state of Hawaii, it's a very relative term. And I try to get that. All right, I'm going all in. You hear it spoken about within people outside of the industry as a very definitive black and white thing. We will never be able to sustain the population of this island. We will always need imports. The closer we can move that needle, the more we can move that needle, we're succeeding. There will never be an end game. There will never be a point where we are sustaining ourselves and our imports are just the things that, you know, can't be produced. And I think the thought process behind that is futile. And the thing that worries me once in a while is I think politically they it makes such a good story that the drive is on this way end of the spectrum. And I just really wish it was a little more of a realistic term because even the governor put forth something that, you know, increasing by 20% by 2020.
Ooh,
no.
That's so,
yeah, I mean, it's not going to happen, you know. But the kind of thing that I think comes down to is you got to have goals. If you don't have goals, you can't, you know, move forward. I think that that's kind of where we come into play. That we are essentially in what could be considered a food desert. I know that's ironic, but when you think of the closest grocery store that way is 20 minutes, same for this way.
Wow.
In Hawaii, that's a long drive, right? 40 minutes is a long drive. So we do have a small retail outlet here that we sell things out of that, you know, seems kind of rinky-dink, but the amount of stuff we run through there is huge. And I think it's just people in the neighborhood. Mm. So the more we can do that type of thing where we're supplementing and we're giving people options, that's the real goal, I think.
So that's for everyone living in Hawaii. But something else we spoke about in our intro episode for this Hawaii miniseries was how sustainability is more than just a marketing shtick or even a problem to solve among Native Hawaiians. It's a way of life. Here's Kialoha Domingo. He's a Hawaiian cultural practitioner who teaches partially through food and cooking.
You know, I have family and that have been growing their own food for forever. You know, till today. You know, my father-in-law, they grew up on a plantation, and you know, the only way they know is to grow their own veggies, you know, their own vegetables, and they always had something, you know, and it's not really a daunting task if you understand the importance of it, you know. On Oahu, you know, yeah, it's a buzzword. People are becoming more and more aware of it. Local produce has been Local First has been a strong model for, you know, I want to say going 15 years now. Although there are so many times when it's so much easier to go step into Costco, you know, and it's right there at your fingertips. But when you understand and you appreciate and you get to know that farmer that grew that produce, when you get to know that farmer that, you know, that he put his good energy, his mana into the soil, into the implements, into everything from seed, from huli, which is the planting media for our taro plant. You know, when you put that huli in the ground, it's a part of you, and that sustainability just flows. It comes naturally. I think the more people understand that, the less likely we are to go to Costco. I mean, you're still going to see me there, you know, buying $200, $300 worth of stuff when I just needed a loaf of bread. But Hawaii in general, things are a little different these days because, you know, we don't have the same access to land, same access to water. We have jobs and careers and bills and, you know, it's not as easy to dedicate your life to it. But there are many more people who are really stepping up to the plate and figuring it out. And as we regain our respect for the food, you know, it becomes less about how much it costs and more about how it came about, how it arrived at your doorstep, how it arrived in your refrigerator, your kitchen, you know.
All the things we love delving into.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we love delving into is history. And we do have some history for you and some chocolate. Not actually, but some information about chocolate, which is almost as exciting.
Oh, but wouldn't it be great if WonkaVision were real and worked via streaming podcasts?
In some instances. I can see others where it would not be.
Oh, gosh. Yep, that's accurate. I'm just thinking of our shows that we produce here in this office. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. But first, we need to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And we're back with sustainability, a history. We humans don't always have a good track record when it comes to taking care of our resources.
Uh-uh.
For our own use and for the use of future generations. But at its most basic definition, a concern for future resources, sustainability has been around about as long as humanity has.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes sense. It has been the driver behind so much technology and innovation throughout our history. However, we aren't always the best at planning ahead and or understanding or caring that resources are finite.
Yeah.
This is how animals have gone and continue to go extinct. Some peoples have had no trouble living in harmony with their environment, while others, not so much. Not so much.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lake in South America supposedly named, in translation, "We fish on our side, you fish on your side, and nobody fishes in the middle."
Oh, I hope that's true.
I hope it's true, too. I love it so much.
I couldn't confirm, but yeah.
Beautiful.
And, okay, so yes, of course, locals have always noticed when X animal stops thriving in an area or Y plant stops yielding as well. Like whether they've cared or been able to figure out the cause and change it varies. But a paradigm shift of humanity's understanding of the breadth and depth of the issue took place during the Industrial Revolution when coal-powered mass production and transportation started ramping up using this oil-hungry machinery, and people could see the impact of that work, dead fish, dirty water and air.
Yeah. And the American Dust Bowl during the 1930s is an excellent or terrible example of people and the government not acting sustainably. In a nutshell, the government recommended wheat farmers in Texas and Oklahoma plow large, high plain areas during a relatively rainy time. However, when the dry season came back around, bringing with it these enormous dust storms through these now unprotected plain areas, farming became essentially impossible, and living in these areas wasn't easy either. In fact, it was often dangerous because of things like dust pneumonia. It was only through years of practices like crop rotation that the situation was remedied.
The original word for sustainability came out of Germany in 1713. I'm going to attempt to say it. Nachhaltigkeit.
Yeah.
That was after like 7 minutes of me trying and failing and cussing a lot. But at any rate, yes, this word, this was the word for sustained yield, applied specifically to sustained forest yield, meaning that you should never harvest trees faster than the forest can regenerate them. Smart idea. It wasn't until the mid-19th century, though, that the word with this general meaning appeared translated into English. From there, it evolved to encompass not just forests, but all biological systems and how humans and the earth coexist. In 1987, we see the Brundtland Commission of the United Nations definition. Sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of the future generations to meet their own needs.
In 2011, the Committee on Incorporating Sustainability in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and a few other organizations got together and they wrote a long report on the subject. They explained that the history of sustainability in the U.S. has three main threads. The first is the many waves of conservation and preservation movements. Starting during the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s and developing through today, these movements all originated with societal concerns that we were destroying many things that we culturally agreed made America great. From these concerns came a number of conservation laws beginning in the late 1800s. This intertwined with growing anxieties around not knowing precisely what was going into our increasingly prepackaged and mass-produced foods. We've talked about 19th century concerns about what was going into packaged bread in previous episodes. Graham crackers?
I think. And Heinz ketchup is near directly responsible for the creation of what would become the Food and Drug Administration.
Right.
Because they were like, well, our bottling practices are clean and safe. All y'all step it up.
Yeah. We don't want to be punished for your bad deeds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other waves of these movements developed as other technologies developed. The canning and freezing of food, all of this mass processing, microwaves, government cheese, massive livestock operations. Spam.
Spam. Spam. Spam. Spam.
And by the 1970s, there was also starting to be a widespread pushback from both environmentalists and cooks against this mass-produced is better, fancier concept that had really reigned during the earlier 1900s.
Which brings us to our second thread, the mounting science and reporting throughout the 20th century around pollution caused by industrial development and how those pollutants may be harmful to humans and the environment as well.
A watershed moment, if you'll forgive the pun, was the 1962 publication of Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, which laid out the effects of pesticides on animals and the environment and potentially humans. The Safe Water Drinking Act would be passed this was a direct response 2 years later in 1964, and DDT pesticides were banned.
In response to growing public pressure, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, was formed in 1970, and we got the first old-school Earth Day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Back in 1969, Congress had passed the National Environmental Policy Act, which was the first major federal environmental law. Its purpose read in part, quote, to create and maintain conditions under which man and nature can exist in productive harmony and fulfill the social, economic, and other requirements of present and future generations of Americans. The 70s is also when permaculture, or a way to farm sustainably without the need for pesticides or synthetic fertilizers, was floated as an option.
And then there's the third thread, which was the growing realization that when we pollute and don't conserve our resources, we're not just hurting ourselves, we're compounding the problems that we experienced for future generations to come. And a worldwide problem like this requires a worldwide solution, and that's where we see the institutionalizing of sustainability efforts through things like international conferences and agreements. The 1992 Earth Summit, or the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, was the first modern example of an agreement around sustainable development. And now, of course, there are so many issues wrapped up in these agreements, like the benefits and penalties and costs and needs for developed versus developing countries. Nothing about this is simple.
Nope. In 1990, the U.S. Congress passed a bill around sustainable farming that read in part, sustainable agriculture means an integrated system of plant and animal production practices having a site-specific application that will, over the long term, provide human food and fiber needs, enhance environmental quality and the natural resource base upon which the agricultural economy depends, make the most efficient use of non-renewable resources and on-farm resources, and integrate, where appropriate, natural biological cycles and controls, sustain the economic viability of farm operations, and enhance the quality of life for farmers and society as a whole.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
One John Elkington proposed the phrase triple bottom line in 1994, rolling up economic and social and environmental value into sustainability.
The 2008 U.S. economic recession recast sustainability as green.
Yeah.
Green jobs, green energy, and the like. Although companies had started pivoting to green marketing as early as 1993.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Advertising Age placed sustainability on its jargoniest jargon list in 2010.
Nevertheless, the popularity of sustainability and its proven profitability did inspire innovations in the farming space, like hydroponics and vertical farming. Individuals are also making more green choices thanks to this marketing, like vegetarianism or veganism, growing their own food, stuff like that.
And all of this brings us more or less to today. And it brings us to chocolate.
Yay!
As we discussed in our chocolate episode, much of our current mass-produced chocolate is not sustainable from a variety of perspectives, from environmental to human rights. Ethical producers are searching for sustainable sourcing and production methods. One company that's part of this movement is the aforementioned Manoa Chocolate Hawaii. Founded by Dylan and Tamara Butterball in 2010, Manoa Chocolate sources cacao from Hawaii where possible. Hawaii is the only U.S. state able to commercially grow cacao.
Mm-hmm.
The Butterballs started right out of college, meaning that funds were scarce and they had to come up with some creative, Willy Wonka-esque solutions. Here's Dylan.
When we first got started, by watching YouTube videos is how we figured out how to build our own equipment. Just because in 2010, they didn't make small-scale chocolate equipment because there weren't that many small chocolate makers. Mm-hmm. But the concept's easy. That shell is light and that nib is heavy. And so by hooking up that little door of the Explorer bicycle, we're able to pedal it, and the front wheel was hooked up to a cracking device that we made out of PVC pipe and plywood. So it'd be spinning away.
They've expanded since then, moving into a bigger space and updating their equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The Willy Wonka vibe is still there, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. To get into the chocolate-making space, you had to pass through heavy wooden castle doors.
It's beautiful.
It really is. And okay, now that we have an interview with a real-deal chocolate maker, let's do a brief refresher on chocolate.
Yeah, we have previously interviewed the excellent folks at French Broad Chocolates, which is another chocolate maker, but we didn't get into this kind of detail with them. And also, that was after our original chocolate episode came out. By the way, Dylan and Tamara know the founders of French Broad, Dan and J.L. Radigan. We mentioned to Dylan that we'd visited, and he was like, oh, yeah, they're so great. And I don't know. It was a very sweet moment.
It was.
Anyway, here's Dylan.
Okay, so chocolate starts as a fruit. Inside are all these seeds. This is 100% chocolate. It's how it starts. It's the pulp is the actual fruit. There's a lot of sugar in that. In fact, I want you to grab one of them, and I want you to eat the pulp.
Okay.
So this is, when people say chocolate's a fruit, you're about to eat the pulp. Now, don't bite it yet.
Okay.
I want you to do that later. But the pulp should be sweet.
So just kind of gnaw the pulp off?
Oh, just put it in your mouth, and you can suck on it.
Oh, wow. It tastes like a tropical fruit.
Yep. So what happens now is you harvest a whole bunch of ripe fruit. You can see some of them get really big. You harvest a whole bunch of them. They grow off the trunks of the trees. The orchards are beautiful. You go through the orchards and there's just all these different colorful sunrisey looking fruit pods hanging in the shade of the trees. And so you clip them all off and you collect hopefully thousands, and you sit there and you crack all these pods open, and then they look like this. Now, that's what you just ate.
Yeah, yeah.
Same thing. All the sugar that's around that starts to get fermented because it goes into a wooden box. You see the wooden box there with the banana leaves?
Yeah, yeah.
All of the sugars get eaten by wild yeasts, and you get a whole bunch of alcohol that's created over the next few days. Then there's a whole bunch of bacteria, wild bacteria, that eat the alcohol and make acetic acid. So when you walk over to a ferment that's going well toward the end, it smells like someone dumped a bunch of vinegar everywhere because there's a bunch of acetic acid that was created. And the reason I wanted to explain all this so well is because this is 90% of quality, happens on the farm.
Yeah.
The quality of the chocolate that we can make is what shows up. So if the farmer didn't do a good job, we can't do a good job.
Yeah.
Now the last step is actually drying, which is an extension of the fermentation. This happens in hoop houses and outside in the sun. So that can be tricky in the tropics. Why don't we head over to, toward the roaster? So you can see here the equator line. Chocolate grows roughly 10 degrees north and south of the equator. That's where the majority of it is, but it'll grow up to about 20 degrees north and south of the equator. And so in Hawaii, we're about 21 degrees latitude. We're surrounded by ocean, so we're still quite tropical and unaffected by crazy weather. Most of it is coming out of these two countries, the Ivory Coast and Ghana. That's where 70% of the world's chocolate comes out of. Everything. People in Siberia and people in Indonesia and India, they're all eating mostly chocolate that came out of Ivory Coast and Ghana. So I just find that amazing all the time. But everything that you see that's highlighted, we have bought from and made into chocolate. So every single one of those countries had a different flavor. And that's the fun part of what we do as a craft chocolate maker. We are trying to make the best chocolate in the world instead of the most. And usually it works the other way around. You're just trying, these big companies would be trying to crank out the most chocolate they possibly can and add a lot of milk and sugar.
Right.
And so we're on the other side of that. We're like craft beer. For beer, it's so, the flavor is so dependent on the yeast that's added.
Yeah.
In chocolate, we know it affects it, but we just don't know how much. And we're kind of at the very beginning of tasting really, really interesting chocolates just because the greater industry focused just on quantity.
Right.
And on the tree, on the growing side, they all focused on disease tolerance and yields. So they didn't care about flavor, whereas we're focused on flavor as the primary.
We got to do a tasting after the tour, and the flavors were pretty spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there was some wine involved. It was lovely. And not a sponsor. We're just fans.
Uh-huh. But right, yeah. So this is something that we noticed throughout Oahu, this desire to use local products. We saw it on menus everywhere we went. One of those menus was MW, and we were fortunate enough to talk with one of the chefs there, Michelle Yoyoka.
Yeah, we ate at MW twice, and it was delicious.
Oh, the second time was unexpected. They were like, oh, you didn't get to eat everything that we think you should have when you were here for dinner a few days ago, so...
Please try all of this food.
Try all the desserts and all the snacks.
And we had a dinner reservation, and we were like, we'll make it work. This is excellent.
It was excellent. Anyway, yes, here's Michelle.
Because a lot of what we do is we want to support our local farmers. We know it's a lot more expensive, but we think it's about sharing it. And that's what makes Hawaii so special. Because if we don't support our local farmers and they go out of business, then we're not sustainable as an island.
Yeah.
We're so reliant on food coming in. What happens if a hurricane hits or something happens, a natural disaster, and we can't get ships coming in or planes coming in, you know. So we have to help increase that. And it's, I think as more people farm, you know, prices start to come down.
And the government is very aware of these issues. We spoke with Hawaii State Senator Donovan Dela Cruz, who devotes a lot of his policy work to agriculture and education. And he was kind enough, to meet us in the aftermath of that poke battle, which again was like hundreds of people clamoring for free samples of poke and like all kinds of noise and confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was coming from an hour away on a Saturday. But yes, here's the senator.
So we should be able to replace a lot more imports. There's no doubt. But we just have to scale things up, and we have to match the demand with production. And so if we, even just our own schools, hospitals, that the state owns, prisons, airports, if the state made a commitment to say we're only going to buy local, then local farmers know that they'll have a consistent customer, which will help them plan. And which will help other people say, well, I'll go in that business now because it's more predictable. So we got to figure out a way to make agriculture more predictable with all these different systems. And then that base, once it's revenue generating, helps us to go into other things and take more risks. But Hawaii has such a strong brand that we could do a lot more value added. You know, and we get in 10 million visitors a year. So a lot of it doesn't even have to be shipped. I mean, we're 10 million people coming through a year, we could sell a lot of value-added products.
But what are some other ways we can all be more sustainable in our food choices? We have some tips for you, but first, we have one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And yeah, so we wanted to wrap up with a pointer about groceries and food choices for you, and also a little bit of a soapbox, both from Taylor of Kualoa Ranch. Here he is.
Don't come with a list. I think that's the best thing. And I think that's even true for restaurateurs is, and you know, as a restaurateur, I can see why this is a difficult ask. So I completely appreciate how it's a difficult ask, but a producer, even one as diverse as us, is never going to have everything you want if you've already made your menu before you contact us. So the idea is work the other way around. I think it's the same with consumers. Don't come with a list. see what you have. You know, I know I've heard stories of CSAs being difficult for people because they just don't know what to do with the stuff.
Sure.
So it's up to us as producers to help with that also. You know, some people put their recipe cards in and things like that. So I feel like the initiative and the desire is already there to work with local producers. I feel like when it is more difficult, and sometimes the challenge is people just kind of going, screw it, you know, I'll go, because it's so much easier to just go to a wholesaler, because you just say, I want 10 pounds of this, 5 pounds of that, and boom, comes to your door, everything, you know. With local producers, you got to go to this guy, and then you got to go to this guy. This guy doesn't have it, so then you got to go to this guy. Oh, recipe's got to change, you know. It's more difficult. But if you can find value in it in your restaurant, economically, it'll work out. But as far as the home consumer goes, I think just, like I said, be open.
And here's the soapbox.
Remember we talked about small batch craft production, which is what I consider myself. And then you talk about commercial agriculture. You talk about the outside of the aisle, the inside of the aisle. You talk about corporate ag versus small farmer. We are fed by a commercial corporate ag system that is now basically a requirement in the United States because we're at a 2% or less of actual food producers versus non-food producers. That was driven by a consumerism mentality that was nobody's fault, that was over 70 years. You know what I mean? So it's not like somebody decided this is the way it should be. It was something that was very, you know, so it's a very large ship. It's a very big, big ship. And you can't make a ship just go and turn all the way around. And I really find sometimes it upsetting when certain things are villainized. Yeah, they probably could be. No doubt they could be improved upon. No doubt there's things that should be changed. No doubt that we should be collectively voicing our opinions to help that change. But I really, really think that if you don't work in food production, be a part of the positive change. Don't villainize and tear people down because it doesn't help anything. I think that's my soapbox. Because it's just really odd. I've never figured that out. Because I'll be the first one to say that we do need to change how we produce, allocate, and distribute food in this country. No question about it. But let's do it through positive change, collective movement, identifying these things, and then helping, whether it be with your dollar, your business, if you're a banker, if you're a landowner, whatever. But I really like to avoid the that's wrong and this is right, particularly when it's very niche and very black and white, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of my thing. We have this saying over here, because if you're a, and maybe it's a saying other places too, but if you grew up here, a lot of people, you go at night on the beach with flashlights and you catch sand crabs. And it's really fun, right? Mm-hmm. We did it last night, actually. We call it crabs in the bucket, because what you'll see is you'll see a crab that'll kind of get to the edge and you'll see all the other crabs try to drag them down. And we call it crabs in the bucket because it seems like there's, you know, we don't want to be crabs in the bucket. We want people to rise to the surface that are doing the right thing. We want to let change happen in a positive way. But you don't need to put yourself in a more positive light or an improved situation at the expense of someone else. I think that's kind of my thing. I never could figure that out. It just doesn't seem cool. It doesn't seem like a cool thing to do. So, yeah, that's my only soapbox.
We do love a good soapbox.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andy's right. We are all together on this huge ship, and it's going to take time for us to implement systemic change. But together, with determination and patience, we can make changes for a more sustainable and healthy planet. For all of us.
Oh, this is reminding me of Spaceship Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, anyway.
Anyway. The choices we make today, from consumers to producers, impact not just us, but future generations too. So we can't afford to not have these discussions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to be a part of the discussion, you can. You can email us at hello@saverpod.com.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram @SaverPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Thank you so much to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard, our executive producer, Christopher Hesiodis, and all of our interviewees, and furthermore to Michelle McGowan Rice of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, Don Sokomoto Paiva of Put It On My Plate, and Joy Goto and Maria Hartfield of the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau for putting us in touch with all of those interviewees. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, you can visit Apple Podcasts, or, you know, wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.